Welcome back to Film Weekly with me, a rested Jason Solomons. Yes, this week's show is hip to the hop as we meet director Scott Sanders to discuss his comic homage to the blaxploitation era with his comedy film Black Dynamite. And fiction is more dangerous than fact for Argentinian director Juan José Campanella. His Oscar-winning The Secret in Their Eyes is released this week, and I'll be talking to him about a tale of injustice and redemption. Zan Brooks joins me to review M. Night Shyamalan's The Last Airbender, Francois Ozon's Le Refuge, and Bob Raffleson's Restored Five Easy Pieces. Yes, sticking it to the man as ever, it's Film Weekly. With its funk and flares, blaxploitation as a genre was born out of the urban grit of African-American culture in the 1970s. But these days, it's more often associated with themed dress-up parties and reissues of rare soundtracks and maybe the work of Quentin Tarantino. So it is with a raised eyebrow and a warm heart that director Scott Sanders has created his comedy homage to the genre in Black Dynamite.
Excuse me, brothers.
The militants turned startled. This is private. How'd you get in here?
I walked in.
So you one of them sneaky brothers, huh? Or maybe you an undercover pig. Or maybe you just a federal hitman.
If I was, you cats would already be dead. Now let me speak to the man in charge.
Sarcastically, I'm in charge. I don't.
If you were in charge, the people might as well surrender to Whitey right now, because your survival skills ain't worth a damn.
Black Dynamite!
With all the genre's narrative tropes, from the eponymous Black Dynamite's need for justice and his potency with the ladies, the film manages to poke fun and celebrate the wild and raucous beauty of the original films, film like Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song and, of course, Shaft. So it's a joy to be joined down the line from LA by Scott Sanders. Scott, welcome to Film Weekly.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm totally digging your film Black Dynamite, I have to say. And it's kind of interesting because here in the UK we have nothing like blaxploitation. It's one of those genres that is uniquely American. What made you want to revisit blaxploitation as a genre?
Well, we are big fans of the movies, and you know, most of the blaxploitation movies took place between 1971 and 1975. I think we just wanted to treat it as a genre film and like throw another blaxploitation movie on top of the pile. There have been a couple of other blaxploitation spoofs, Undercover Brother, I'm Gonna Get You Sucker, but none of them had actually been set in the 70s.
Yeah, and there was Hollywood Shuffle as well, Robert Townsend film, I remember from way back
as
well.
Yeah, I mean, most of them were just sort of products of their time, or in the case of Undercover Brother, I think it's in the future.
Yeah, I think it's like the Austin Powers, like there's what's her name, Cleopatra, Foxy Cleopatra that Beyonce plays in the Austin Powers.
Oh, yeah,
kind
exactly.
Of out of time kind of characters.
Yeah, we just wanted to do one exactly like a blaxploitation movie, but, you know, when you go back to something that's 30 years old and the world kind of turned out a different way, it lends itself to comedy. So it was a fun thing because the comedy came very naturally. I felt like it felt like an organic process.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're just things that we observed. And, I mean, there's so many things in Black Dynamite that were actually in other blaxploitation films.
Yeah, can you list a few? Because I actually, it's one of my favorite genres, so I'm a big fan of Richard Roundtree and Jim Brown and all those and Pam Grier. I have a whole box set of Chuck Turner and all this and Shaft and everything. And I'm a big fan. But can you tell us some of the kind of the direct lifts that you made, some of the films that you watched that you perhaps and Michael J. White kind of sat down and watched?
Sure. In the movie, there is a pimp council where a group of pimps have a meeting. That's very similar to the movie Willie Dynamite, where they also have a pimp council.
Right.
The boom shot that hits Black Dynamite in the head, the boom mic that hits Black Dynamite in the head is, you know, it happens in Dolomite all the time. Black Dynamite's mostly patterned after Jim Brown, and there's some things that Jim Brown does in movies that Michael Jai White is very good at picking up. Like, when Jim Brown shoots a gun, he blinks a lot. And so when Black Dynamite was using the nunchucks, he's kind of blinking during the process.
Yeah, it's good to see nunchucks, but there's not enough of them in films these days. He and satin underwear as well, I think, is a very crucial kind of part. He looks hot in his satin underwear, if I may say. Did you have to be careful? Is there a sort of element in black culture that kind of would suggest, well, you don't criticize the afro, you don't kind of take the Mickey out of that movement, the Panthers, because in the end, you know, these are kind of heroic kind of parts of African American culture as much as they are to be spoofed now.
There are lots of things that we find funny, but at the same time, I think we look back on those times as a sort of a labor of love. Like, yeah, I mean, these movies were important for Black Americans at the time, and yes, there are lots of things that happened funny in them. You know, I mean, like, those two things work together for us, and it's not like we're just, I don't know, the things that we're kind of poking fun at, it's not like we don't love those things.
Oh, no, absolutely. You know, I mean, yeah. And it comes across. I like the look as well. I don't know how you got that special look with your cinematographer. It looked like it was shot on, like, really old stock, or some of it was kind of messed. I don't know, some of it was found footage. Is that right? You use green screen. And am I right in thinking that there was some, like, outtake? There's an archive that you can use some kind of, you know, old TV footage and kind of put your you know, green screen your kind of characters on?
Yeah, well, the film stock we used was Super 16 color reversal stock, which people don't use a lot, and it really gives it that look. And then also we did use stock footage from actual blaxploitation movies and TV shows from the 70s. I mean, there's a ton of footage we actually bought from Sony, you know, like from Charlie's Angels, the TV show, and, you know, just found 70s footage that we actually built a lot of the story around. Like, there are certain things that I didn't have in the script, and then all of a sudden, like, for instance, we found a helicopter that picks up a 70s car. So he's like, okay, let's work that into the story.
No, that was good. A good helicopter. It made me think you had a great budget.
Exactly. It was like, you know, that stuff's not that expensive. You know, it's like maybe $500 or $600 a shot.
Right. Because, so, I mean, looking at your film, it occurs to me, I don't know if you, I'm sure you do know that the Melvin Van Peebles homage to his dad's own Sweet Sweetbacks. He made a documentary kind of film called Badass about the making of Sweet Sweetbacks and how that was done on the hoof. And it's a great little movie, I'm sure you know. But you must have, it seems to me that you, as kind of guerrilla comedy makers, must have been kind of back where Melvin Van Peebles was when he was making that in the first place.
Yeah, it actually, I think that's what the fun of it was, is we didn't have it. It really was like a blaxploitation movie because we didn't have any money. So it just so happened that, like, it worked to our favor because that's the genre.
But one of the things that one always associates with blaxploitation is the kind of funky wah-wah guitar riffs, and people like Curtis Mayfield and James Brown and you know, Bobby Womack, and all those brilliant songs. Presumably, you were torn between kind of going for that old funk and making an original soundtrack, which you do, and it's quite extraordinary because it sounds like, you know, I was looking and thinking, wow, this must have been taken from some kind of blaxploitation movie, I don't know, some soundtrack. But no, it's all original stuff.
Yeah, well, half of it's original stuff, and then actually half of it comes from the UK. It comes from the KPM Library, where so half of it comes from a good friend of mine who I was, you know, previously a DJ, and I met a good friend of mine who's obsessed with funk music. His name's Adrian Young.
Mm-hmm.
He's also the film's editor as well. And so he has all these vintage instruments, and he just made the soundtrack. And so most of the stuff that has to, you know, like a lot of the blaxploitation movies, they tell the story in the song while the movie is occurring. So a lot of that stuff, or all that stuff, Adrian made. And then a lot of the incidental music comes from the, you know, the funk libraries of Europe, more specifically KPM, where, you know, in the 70s, they, to avoid union rules here in America, they would have, you know, production music from the 70s, and there are all these great British composers who made really, really funky stuff. And so it was really fun to go through that library and pick out little cues here and there.
Great, so we got the funk right here in England. I'm glad.
Oh, absolutely.
What are you doing next, Scott, may I ask?
I'm working on a film right now. It's going to be like the same group of people, trying to do a Jamaican zombie movie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's going to be a We're hopefully getting close to announcing it, but I've been kind of working on that for a while.
Right. Well, have you got a title for that? I mean, the mind boggles.
We're trying to figure out the title, but I'm just trying to. It's about a. There's a zombie weed that's going around. It's the weed so strong that it turns people to zombies. It's sort of like I'm trying to make it sort of like a District 9 sort of thing.
Yeah, okay, fantastic. District 9 meets kind of, you know, Saturday or Cheech and Chong, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Oh, I'm loving it already. You've got a fan. Please come back on Film Weekly and we'll have a toke and we'll talk about that one. It'll be fantastic.
Absolutely.
And I don't want an excuse that you got so high that you couldn't come back on the show, because that wouldn't be... Don't, as a director, you mustn't get high on your own supply. You know this. I'm preaching to the converted here. Scott Sanders, thank you very much indeed. From blaxploitation to hacksploitation, from Shaft to Shafting, I'm joined by my fellow critic Zan Brooks as we look at some of the week's other releases, including The Last Airbender. We'll look at François Ozon's Le Refuge. We'll look at Five Easy Pieces, Jack is Back. And we'll also look at The Secret in Their Eyes. Zan, welcome back.
Thank you, Jason.
The Last Airbender, M. Night Shyamalan. Are you a fan of his?
No, I'm not at all. So let's proceed.
Did you like, on with the Shafting, did you like even Sixth Sense?
I thought Sixth Sense was a sort of decent film, obviously augmented with the great twist at the end, which I seem to remember I didn't see coming.
No, I didn't see it coming. I never see twists coming.
No, me neither. But that didn't make it any less successful and well-engineered.
Twists piss me off.
Do they?
Well, because I've watched a film and then they go, aha, but actually...
Oh, no, but there's difference between a good twist and a bad twist.
Yeah, his twists piss me off.
His twists can be irritating, particularly when they become... You know, the routine,
yeah.
The sort of chubby checker routine that he does in every single film.
Let's twist again. It's M. Night Shyamalan. Let's twist again, indeed. Let's go into The Last Airbender. This is where Fire Prince Zuko, played by Slumdog Millionaire's Dev Patel, captures Aang, who's played by Noah Ringer. So his uncle, Iroh, can conduct a test on the boy to find out whether he is or isn't the Avatar.
You are my prisoner, Airbender. I'm taking you back to the Fire Nation.
You said I...
I apologize. I should have explained further. If you failed the test, as all others did, you were free to leave. But as it turns out, you are the only one in the entire world who could pass this test. It is truly an honor to be in your presence.
And with such mumbo-jumbo, we launch into attacking The Last Airbender. I assume we're going to attack it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we should probably get the cheap schoolboy giggles out of the way first. This is basically a film about a couple of benders who ride around massive benders.
Some of the world's biggest benders.
And they ride around the world on a what seemed to be a flying beaver.
Yeah.
And if that floats your boat, then you're all set.
Absolutely. I must just say that I know I've complained in the past of why didn't someone say something to him about, you know, a script that sort of talks about benders. We are the only territory for which this is a problem.
Yeah, and possibly the only generation. I'm not sure even if it's used as a sort of cheap schoolboy insult anymore.
Yeah, anyway. Well, it shouldn't be, really.
It really shouldn't
be. It's
naughty
and silly.
But it does slightly put you at a distance from wanting to be seen as a deeply spiritual, moving soulful film.
But the thing
film.
Is, it's not just the fact that everyone needed it is a bender that is the problem with it.
No, but there's only a couple of benders in it, because they're always singled out and dragged off by armed guards saying, he's a bender.
Yeah, I know.
We don't allow benders in this village.
It's a bit like, you're thinking, is this really what it's
a little bit dodgy, isn't it?
I know. I thought so too. And I thought, could it be seen as a kind of, you know, sexuality kind of
I think you're crediting him with too much...
I think we certainly... So what on earth is The Last Bender about? Or fire, or water, or air?
Well, it's about the elements, isn't it? It's an elemental epic where the world is divided between the tribes of fire, water, air, and salt, I think.
In what? Are we in the past, or are we in the future?
We are in a land that no man has gone to.
I think it's a realm.
Before.
I think this is definitely a film set in a realm.
Yeah, this is the realm, isn't it? And it really starts out with the Star Wars credits, doesn't it? The kind of opening captions scrolled over the black screen. It's really going for that big, COD, grandiose vibe and fails spectacularly. I mean, this is, I think one of the most spectacularly awful films I've seen in ages.
Yeah, but it's,
and as such, is utterly mesmerising.
Well, no, I thought it wasn't bad enough. Really.
It wasn't bad enough. No, I found it
thoroughly boring and stupid and pointless. And normally terrible films are kind of car crash to watchable. You know,
yeah.
Kind of enjoyable. Or funny, at least.
I was watching it, though, thinking this is going to be a cult classic at some point. This is going to be one of those films like Plan 9 from Outer Space that are shown at conventions and people dress up and come along to. And it's, you know, it's at the moment it's run into a lot of trouble, apart from the cheap bender aspect to it, with Shyamalan being basically accused of a kind of eugenics where he's whitewashed the cast that were played, the characters in the original TV series that this is based on, which I have to say I've never seen.
I have never seen it either. That shows how shallow I am.
It does, yeah. And so people are, the fans of that are furious about this. They also seem to be furious about the fact that the character of Ung is pronounced Ang in the TV series, and it's Ung here, which is another terrible travesty.
This is awful.
Absolutely shocking.
He's also one of the world's worst child actors.
He's awful, isn't he? But, you know, he's given a good run for his money by all the other actors in this film, including, I have to say, Dev Patel, who plays the exiled Fire Prince, and just looks both confused and irritable.
I remember sitting with Dev Patel at one of the Critics' Do's or Awards' Do's when, you know, Slumdog was marching irresistibly to glory, and he was nominated for Young Performer, New Performer, Best Actor, all this. And he was charming, and everyone was like, oh, it's great for Dev, isn't it? And I was like, I said, you know, you must turn up to all these things and just kind of, you know, love this, because it doesn't happen a lot. And I think he didn't believe me. I think he thought that every film you make kind of, you know, this happens to. This is a bit of a slap in the face, isn't it?
He should have listened to you that night.
I know what I'm talking about.
You do. You do. You can point him in the right direction.
I should be his agent from now on. Shall we move to François Ozon and Le Refuge?
I think that's very sensible.
Or The Hideaway, as it's called in English.
No, let's call it Le Refuge.
I think we should call it Le Refuge. François Ozon, a prolific director who we've had on the show before, here back on his kind of chamber form, a film starring Isabelle Carré as a pregnant woman who wakes from a coma, is told she's pregnant, and that the person who did it to her is dead.
Vous avez été hospitalisé ici d'urgence il y a deux jours, et vous êtes resté dans un état comateux pendant plus de 6 heures. Vous avez fait, mademoiselle, une overdose d'héroïne. Vous êtes passée très près de la mort. Dites-moi, est-ce que vous pouvez me dire quand vous avez vos règles pour la dernière fois?
Je sais pas.
Poor Isabelle Carré. That's what happens if you're a smack addict in Paris, Zan. There's a lesson for us all here.
There is a lesson for us all here, and it's very well told, I think.
Because she goes on from here, she goes into her refuge, she goes to Hideaway to recover from her...
We wouldn't use the last scene as a clip, would we?
No, that I don't think so.
Irresponsible.
That would be a spoiler as well.
Yes, she goes, she retreats. She's basically a junkie, and her junkie boyfriend is dead. She is carrying his child. She retreats to a little cottage on the coast, where she is visited by the brother of her dead boyfriend,
right,
who's gay, who is played by Louis Ronan Choisy.
Yes, who also wrote the music and soundtrack to the film.
Yes.
Because he's a singer.
He's a singer.
He's well known in Paris as well.
And a very good actor on this
show. Yeah, I thought very charismatic.
Both of them, I thought, were superb. I think Carré particularly was absolutely great, in that she's, you know, she's playing a character who's scarred by her past and terrified by her future. And she is never entirely likable, because she's like clenched. She's like a sort of clam closed up on the beach.
And she's also pregnant and still shooting up methadone.
Yeah.
So, which is, you know, some people may have a moral issue with it. I'm not that kind of parent.
Yeah, and going out to nightclubs and kind of hurling herself around on the dance floor.
Which is not what I did during my pregnancy.
I would hope not.
Good.
But in all that, she manages to be sort of sympathetic.
Yeah, I think she's a really lovely actress. I've been sort of a fan of hers for a long time. You kind of think, well, where have I seen her before? She's kind of popped up in many little films. There was one that she did with Audrey Tautou called I Love You, I Love You Not, when she was excellent. And she's got a kind of madness in her eyes.
She reminded me a little bit of the young Isabelle Huppert, a little bit, in that kind of the demure sort of French, basically, you know, the ingenue, but with something there, some sort of steeliness or as you say, some madness.
She was also really pregnant when she shot the film, made it. I believe he offered the part to his former muse, Ludovine Seignier, who was pregnant at the time. Mm. I think he was waiting for one of the actresses to be pregnant, and he kind of rung them all up and sort of said, will you do it? And only Isabelle Carré did it. And there was a certain sort of window where she could do it between 4 months and 5 months. And I thought she did it rather brilliantly. This is Ozon back on that sort of small, intimate film that he did. He's tried a sort of
He's a very eclectic director,
isn't he?
And normally I would say he's probably drawn to the stylistic flourish, and this is very naturalistic, very almost dour at times, yeah. Even though it's sun-splashed and set on the beach. But it's made with absolute confidence, and it's a small film. It's a short film. I think it clocks in under an hour and a half.
Yeah.
But within that, it does contain so much, and it absolutely grips you.
And there's a kind of sensuality and a sexuality to it that I found that in his shorts, he's a filmmaker who I've really admired for a really long time. And there was one short he made called A Summer Dress, which was set on a beach somewhere like this. Mm. I don't know where it is, sort of on the Atlantic coast, somewhere down there, because there are sort of gun turrets on the beach, aren't there? And you go, where is that? And that had a kind of real lightness to it. It made you want to kind of go to that beach and take your clothes off and run into the sea. And this film sort of does that too, but it's kind of the flip side of it. It's not kind of upbeat. It obviously goes into a slightly darker territory.
Yeah, and it sort of reminded me a bit of some of Roma's films, like A Summer's Tale, but it's darker and bleaker.
Yeah, absolutely. François Ozon's Le Refuge. Looks like we're liking this one.
Yeah, I thought it was good.
Five Easy Pieces, a film clearly indebted to the European School of New Wave Filmmaking, shot by Laszlo Kovacs, directed by Bob Raffleson, and starring Jack Nicholson. It's restored, it's back on the big screen, and here he is, Bobby Dupuis, talking to his father in a wheelchair.
I don't know if you'd be particularly interested in hearing anything about me. My life, most of it doesn't add up to much that I could relate as a way of life that you'd approve of. I move around a lot. Not because I'm looking for anything really, but because I'm getting away from things that get bad if I stay. Auspicious beginnings, you know what I mean?
Sam, when I first saw Five Easy Pieces, I thought, wow, that's cool. I want to be Jack Nicholson. I want to play piano on the back of a truck. I want to be rude to waitresses in diners. I'm not quite sure that I've still got that as much rebel admiration for it at the time. I think it's slightly dated, this film.
No, you come to Five Easy Pieces at different stages of your life, and it says something different to you. And I agree. I had the same response to it. But it's like reading Catcher in the Rye. The first time you read it, you think, I want to be Holden Caulfield. Yeah. And the second time you read it, you think, he's an idiot. And then maybe the third time you read it, you think, oh, he's just a really screwed up kid.
Right.
And I think that's...
Start feeling sorry for him.
Yeah, exactly.
Give him a cuddle.
Yeah, and that's the... As you get older, the film stays the same, but your response to it completely changes. And that's the great genius, I think, of Five Easy Pieces, which I don't think it has changed. You're saying it's born out of the European cinema, which of course it is, but it's a classic American tale of, you know, what constitutes American individualism and the lure of the frontier and, you know, westward expansion and all that. But it's also, it's almost like a riposte to Easy Rider, which of course Nicholson was in and was made the previous year.
Yeah, and shot by Laszlo Kovacs, and also starred Karen Black as well.
Which was all about the joys of that kind of footloose lifestyle and the open road. And this is the sort of the consequence of it and the reality of it, I guess. And I was reminded of the John Updike when he wrote Rabbit Run.
Yeah.
Said that he wrote it as his riposte to On the Road, which was basically, he wanted to say that what happens when a man lights out for the territories is that the people around him get hurt, and perhaps he even hurts himself.
So you sort of see this in the iconography of Jack Nicholson, that this is sort of Captain America, but he can't do it. He can't manage it.
He can't do it because he's tied down. Yeah. He's got family commitments. He's got, and also the key thing, I guess, is that he's not running to anything. He's running away from stuff.
Yes, that is the key.
And that's what makes it a really poignant, sad film, even though it's also bawdy and a bit crude and rollicking.
Yeah, I mean, I still enjoy the kind of working class milieu. It's one of those rare American films that's actually sort of about elitism and class.
Yeah.
Reminds me more of something like, I say it's from the European tradition, it actually reminds me quite a lot of sort of the British working class tradition of, like, say, Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, or this Sporting Life.
Definitely, but with also with the Americans, you know, we're making cultural generalisations here, but America's kind of slight cultural suspicion or fear of the intellectual in the middle class, that the Nicholson character Bobby Dupuis is actually a middle class piano prodigy who's rebelled against all that and is posing as a sort of blue collar oil worker.
Yeah.
And it is that flight from privilege.
Yeah, it reminded me, of course, of The Beat My Heart Skipped with Roman Duris, I think, which obviously has kind of, which Jacques Audiard has said that Five Easy Pieces is obviously was an influence on that, even though it was a remake of
Fingers, yeah.
Which I presume it was an influence on in the first place. Zan, thank you very much. You can, of course, read all of Zan's reviews and thoughts on guardian.co.uk/film. This year's Best Foreign Film category at the Oscars was exceptionally strong, with Michael Haneke's White Ribbon, Jacques Audiard's A Prophet in competition, and Ajami from Israel. But it was a film called A Secret in Their Eyes by Argentinian director Juan José Campanella that took the Oscar, and this week it gets its UK release. The film tells the story of a retired legal officer who decides to resolve the romantic issues in his life by writing a novel based around the brutal murder of a woman some 20 years earlier.
La planta de begonias.
¿Por qué?
Porque hace más de 20 años que me vengo distrayendo. Tribunales, las causas, los amigos, las joditas, un matrimonio, varios affairs. Me distraje.
The extraordinary Argentinian actor Ricardo Darín there as Benjamin Esposito and Soledad Villamil as his former boss Irene. So to tell me more about The Secret in Their Eyes, I'm joined on the line by Juan José Campanella now from Buenos Aires. Muchas gracias, Juan, y bienvenido a Film Weekly.
No, thank you so much for calling.
Congratulations on winning the Oscar as well. I'm going to take you back to that night in March. There's Jacques Audiard's A Prophet, there's Michael Haneke's The White Ribbon, there's Ajami from Israel, and there's you, and you win. How did that feel?
Well, the feeling is quite strange, you know, because you have been anticipating this for a long time. It's a kind of a dream, you know, come true. But then when it actually happens, the feeling is quite different. First of all, you realize that it's still you, you know. There's no magical thing happened. But you have to keep under control. You have to walk to the stage. You have to try to say something coherent in English, which, you know, maybe you didn't notice, but it's not my native language.
Not at all.
And then you have this big countdown right in front of you that goes 40, 39, 38, 37. And it's really quite nerve-wracking, and you have to try to keep so much under control that by the time that you are free to celebrate, the feeling, the moment is gone.
Yeah. And it was a big, I mean, I tell you, here it was a big surprise because, I mean, we, you know, The White Ribbon had won in Cannes, and of course A Prophet was very successful in the on the festivals here in Europe, and your film wasn't out in Europe yet. Very few people had seen it here in Europe. So,
yes.
And everyone thought that the Haneke film was fantastic and the Audiard film was fantastic, and then there you came, and it was like, oh my God,
they are fantastic.
Let's just set the film up a bit here for people who haven't seen it. It's about Ricardo Darín, who is, he's writing a novel in the present day, but he thinks back to the 70s, to this case where there was a beautiful woman who was murdered, and he has to search for the murderer. And he goes about his business in Buenos Aires trying to do it. But yet it's also not just him tracing a murder. It's him kind of trying to trace his own life as well, isn't it? It's kind of the facts overtake the fiction, if you like.
Well, yes. The that's another thing that was very interesting to me in making the movie, and that I thought that set it apart from your regular cold case subgenre. It was not the motivation for the man to go and reopen the case, so to speak, in his memory, was not to, quote-unquote, find the guilty, but it was to find the root of his own loneliness. And that made it like a very metaphysical motivation that set everything apart, and everything that follows, it gives it a very different tone and a very different atmosphere.
It's also about the nature of memory and what we distort as fact and what we kind of remember about a certain era, and in fact the nature of truth as well. Were you investigating that? I mean, on a wider sense about your country as well.
Yes. Also, you know, the movie takes place in 1974 and 1975, which is before the dictatorship. And there haven't been any movies made about that period.
The 70s seem to dominate a lot of filmmaking from Latin America at the moment. I'm thinking of Tony Manero, of course, from Chile only last year, which was about, you know, a man seduced by American cinema in a way, in Saturday Night Fever's character.
Yes,
there.
Yes, yes.
Your characters also kind of make a lot of references to Perry Mason and Mike Hammer and American detective novels. These are guys who are kind of seduced by the ideas of playing detective or being in a noir, even though they're in a kind of, you know, more prosaic kind of everyday.
That's the thing, and that's what I liked about the novel, the original novel on which the movie is based very much. It was the idea of mixing a genre, a very noirish storyline, a very literary or film genre storyline with really everyday characters. The characters are not literary. The characters are very real. We can, you know, I could empathize with them with the way they, not only with the way they spoke, but with the way they approached this quote-unquote investigation. They are afraid. They make mistakes. They're not stupid, but they get to the scenes in the way that we as normal people would. When they see a corpse, they get affected by it. They're not these cold, aloof detectives from film noir.
No, exactly.
Or these stoic policemen.
And I think
these are real people.
When you set it in the 70s, you know, it's very interesting. It's not that long ago, but you kind of think, well, why don't they just, you know, call each other on the mobile phone or kind of use a computer? But of course, none of this technology was available. And I suppose that made it a sort of more difficult era in which to find someone. You know, you think these days maybe your story couldn't happen because they'd easily find someone by his credit cards or by his mobile phone. But now, finding someone in a football crowd is impossible in the 70s.
Oh, exactly, exactly. And actually, I don't want to spoil anything, but the way they do find him, it's really the way the way that they used to go about it. You know, you start with somebody's traits more than all the information.
Yeah, it was more like The Day of the Jackal, your film. But there is a scene in your film which is just a wonderful scene. It's my favourite scene set in a football stadium ever, I think. It is just brilliant. Can you tell me how you... Because it's one shot, isn't it, that you do from above and you go swooping into the football stadium. Where is that football stadium? And how did you create that 1974
yes, it's
football
one shot
stadium?
That starts sort of like 2 miles away from the stadium and it dives into the audience and it goes through the audience and through the bleachers and into the innards of the stadium and jumping from a wall and ends in the middle of the field. Obviously, we didn't do it in one shot.
No.
I have to confess.
Uh-huh. It's the hand of God. You're going to tell me it's the shot of God now.
Exactly. Yeah, we try to throw a camera operator from a helicopter into the bleachers, but after we killed the couple, we forgot about that idea. No, there's a lot of techniques. You know, we did it very in a crafty way. I always say I can do things well, fast, and cheap. Pick any two. So, to do it well and cheap, we took like 9 months to do it. We were about 10 technicians working on a basement and doing it pretty much by ourselves.
Right. Well, it
and
was very
really,
worth it.
I mean, to me, my biggest compliment in that department was that someone, when we were at the Oscars in Hollywood, someone comes to me in a party and says, "That shot, how did you guys do it? I couldn't believe it. It was fantastic." And I explained to him, you know, how we joined the things and like that. And then I asked him, "So, do you?" "Yes, I work in effects." "Any movie that I know of?" "Avatar," he tells me. So I immediately call everybody in Argentina and say, "Guys, just one..." Some guy who did Avatar was very impressed by our shot.
Felicidades. It worked absolutely brilliantly. I think Diego Maradona couldn't have made a free kick and the ball bend any better than you did with your cameras in that moment.
Thank you so much.
It's been a great pleasure talking to you about your film. I wish it the best of luck here on release in the UK. The reviews have been ecstatic for it as well. And I think most people were like, "Oh dear, that film, it beat The White Ribbon and it beat The Prophet," which we all loved. But I think everyone is gradually seeing that it was very well deserved as well. So congratulations. Thanks for joining us on Film Weekly and hasta la próxima.
Hasta la próxima. Thank you so much.
Adios.
Muchas gracias.
And muchas gracias to Juan José Campanella there. Thanks to all my guests indeed on this week's show. The music featured on the podcast is by Alan Tew, the British composer whose music forms the funk-infused soundtrack to Black Dynamite. And if you caught my Gainsbourg special edition of Film Weekly, then you'd know we ran a competition for 3 copies of that soundtrack. We asked you which song did Bardo and Gainsbourg sing in homage to the legendary couple of American gangsters. It was, of course, Bonnie and Clyde. We had lots of entries, and the winners are Benedict from Wellington in New Zealand. Wow. Exotic, huh? And a much more prosaic, but no less deserving, Claire from Morecambe and James from Lancaster here in the UK. Your CDs are on the way to you already. congratulations to you. That is all for this week's show. Do pick up a copy of The Observer on Sunday for the best film news, reviews, and my trailer trash column, of course. Till next week, from me, Jason Solomons, and my Film Weekly producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.